Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Good evening, everyone. This is Dr. Kate. Just starting the show, just a little bit late. Hello, everyone who's on has got a live mic. We're waiting for Terry.
Hi, Kate. It's Dwayne.
Good evening. I just see Terry right now, and I've got him live. Terry. Terry Dodd.
I'm just trying to figure out what's on here and get it out of my ear. Well, welcome to Walls in Our Minds. We'll get our technical difficulties squared away here in just a moment, please, if you'll bear with me for just a moment. All right, I believe we're okay now. This is Terry Dodd, and you have reached Walls in Our Minds. Do we have Red Beckman live yet?
I'm live.
All right. Good evening, Red. Kurt, you're there?
I am. Good evening.
Good evening, Kurt. How about Dwayne? Do we have Dwayne on yet?
Yep, I'm here.
Dwayne, would you please open us in prayer?
I'd be delighted to. Oh, our Creator, our wonderful, heavenly, awesome Creator, Father, we thank you so much. You're unveiling all of this lies, all of these deceitful things that we can show to the world. Father, you said that knowledge shall be increased in the end, and that's what's taking place. We are unveiling the lies of the other side. Father, we ask that you would bring us all together in a form of unity that many others have never seen before to glorify the truth of what's taking place in our nation right now. Put it upon all of us that we would do everything it takes to make sure every note, every word, every syllable comes the way you would have it produced, that we might all glorify your name in truth, the glory of your kingdom. Hallelujah. Amen.
Hallelujah and amen. Thank you, Dwayne. Well, to start out our show tonight, we've got a lot of things planned for this evening's show. And to get us started, Kurt, I'm going to turn the floor over to you and Red. And I know that, Kurt, you've been looking forward to this interview, and I'm going to let you have it.
Well, thank you very much, Terry. Yeah, you know, I have been looking forward to this, Red, and I really appreciate that you're doing this. And I'm glad that hopefully you're feeling better. In the conversations we've talked about in the past, there's one message that you've consistently kind of have come back to as a very critical message, and I haven't really had a chance to explore that with you to the depth that I'd like to understand it. And I think that is your comment that the Seventh Amendment is perhaps the most important thing of all. And I'm going to just read it real briefly. In suits at common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise reexamined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of common law. Would you go ahead and explain what the importance of this amendment is?
I would just be thrilled to death to explain. We are so mentally crippled that to grasp what the Seventh Amendment really, the value of it, is really difficult to pick up on, for the simple reason I know this because of my own experience. I have talked about the Seventh Amendment and the importance of it for 25 years at least, and I'll never forget a patriot group in the West, namely California. They came up with this sovereignty argument there many years ago, and they tried to enlist me in their promotion, and I asked them, I said, well, where do you exercise your sovereignty? Where do you exercise it and confirm the fact that you are sovereign? And they had no answer. They said, you just have to declare it. That doesn't do it. And of course, I wrote in my little book, Walls in Our Minds, that I did in 1989, I put in there just a little blurb about how that judges and such have a conflict of interest. Government employees have a conflict. I'm getting ahead of myself here. They have a conflict of interest because they are tax consumers. They are beneficiaries of the tax laws. And so if you have any kind of a controversy between a citizen and any agency of government, it doesn't make any difference what agency of government it is. It isn't just the IRS. It's FDC or FIC or whoever. It don't make any difference who it is. If there's a conflict, a controversy is the word I need to use because that's the word used in the Seventh Amendment. If there's a controversy between the citizen and a government agent, an agency of the government, the government cannot put one of their judges to preside over, a hearing or a trial or whatever, because the agency that's making the complaint, they and the judge are buddies. They probably never saw each other and never met each other in their lives, but they have that common element there where they are both tax consumers. They both work for the government. Therefore, you are not going to get a fair trial. You don't have to go by what another agency of government, another employee of government, you don't let them judge this. You go to your fellow Americans. You go to the common law, and that's where you get your remedy. Now, you go to the First Amendment. The reason I say that it is the most important of all, I want to explain that right now, because the First Amendment has five clauses in it. You have the freedom of speech and the freedom of press, the freedom to assemble, the freedom of religion. You have the freedom to petition for redress of grievance. And you will notice when you read the First Amendment, there is no enforcement. There is no clue there where you have to go if you are damaged. If your right to free speech has been hindered or damaged in any way by someone in government, where do you go for justice? Where do you get a remedy? If it's a bureaucracy that has said you can't use free speech, you're not going to trust a judge who is also an employee of the government. You're not going to trust him. He has a conflict of interest. And he may have a reputation as being very fair and level-headed and all of that, but he has a conflict of interest because he, too, is a government agent. We've got to get this through and into our heads is the fact that anyone who is a tax consumer as an employee of government is a government agent. I don't care if he's the janitor that sweeps the floor in the federal building or whether it's the judge that has his chambers up on the higher floor someplace. It doesn't make any difference. There is no enforcement of those five clauses involved in the First Amendment. That one, of course, is one of the favorites of the civil libertarians, of course. And they like the Fourth Amendment very well. The civil libertarians, they just refer to the Fourth Amendment. This is the calling for your privacy and your security in your houses, your papers and effects. And here again, you will find that you have no enforcement incorporated within the amendment. You go to the Fifth Amendment. Oh, my, this is a favorite of the civil libertarians as well, and the lawyers and the judges, of course. There's no enforcement. Nothing in the way of enforcement. How do you get, where's your remedy if you have been damaged, if you have been injured in some way by the activities of another government agent in a, you know, OSHA or whatever. You have to go to the Seventh Amendment. The Seventh Amendment is where your remedy is for any violation of law or your constitutionally secured rights between the citizen and government. And that's where most of the problems arise and there where the controversies are, they're the ones that we hear about all the time. They're the ones that we really understand. We know what they are all about, the OSHA, and, of course, all these alphabet soup outfits. And so in the Seventh Amendment, it says there very, very clearly, if in suits of common law, if the value in it, I'm having problems here. If the value in controversy exceeds $20, and that $20 was a lot more money back then than it is today, and this is one of the things where the government has trapped itself because inflation has made it so that $20 is pretty easy to come by anymore. But the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, is not that easy to change. So it was $20 back there when the Bill of Rights was accepted in December of 1791, and it's still $20. Now, what happens is this, and this is the way it's supposed to be. This is the way it was back there. A couple of hundred years ago, if there was a controversy developed between a citizen and an agency of the government, there would be a common law, Seventh Amendment, jury trial. And there would be a judge sitting on the bench. However, he would not be allowed to make any finding of fact or conclusion of law. Basically, what he is there for is to maintain the order of the court and kind of keep things from developing the fisticuffs or something like that. But he's available if there's a question that needs to be answered. He is there to just observe the proceedings, and the proceedings don't have to follow. The proceedings such as lawyers and judges set up for equity and admiralty court cases. It turns out, you see, each side can, you know, they can subpoena the witnesses they need and all. And you see, today, winning a case against a federal agency is very difficult because the judges are manipulating. Well, just to give you an example, I was subpoenaed to testify in a trial, an income tax trial in Portland, Oregon. The Marshal Service gave me an airline ticket to Portland, and I made the trip. It took my time away from more important things, I believe, but I was subpoenaed, and I had to answer that subpoena. I had to be there. And I was there for a couple of days. And finally, they wanted to call me as a witness. And Judge Burns, federal judge presiding, said, no, you cannot call Mr. Beckman because Mr. Beckman is not an expert. I wasn't a CPA, I wasn't a tax preparer, but I had a reputation of being more knowledgeable than most tax attorneys and such. But Judge Burns had the authority, he thought, and he exercised the authority that he really didn't have, because this was a criminal trial. And the fellow on trial wanted me as a witness, and the Sixth Amendment, of course, says that you're supposed to have the witness of your choice, of course, and you're supposed to be able to decide who your witnesses are going to be. But in that case, Judge Burns decided that he was not going to hear Red Beckman. And, of course, Red Beckman, the judges all knew that I was involved in the research and such of the 16th Amendment fraud. And that was something that the Internal Revenue Service and the judge or any other government agency, they just could not afford to let me testify in a court of law where it would be a matter of record that we had thousands of pages of certified documents proving the 16th Amendment was a total, absolute fraud perpetrated by government agents, government people. And so the fellow that was on trial went to jail because he was not allowed to have the witnesses that he was supposed to have. The same goes for a Seventh Amendment trial. You have the right to call your witnesses, and you have the right to get their testimony, and the judge cannot step in and say, no, you can't have that witness. That's not the way it works. Now, the Seventh Amendment, could I bother you to just read right from your copy there? I should have had a copy right
in front
of me.
I'd be happy to do that. But read it. I want to ask a couple of questions before we do that. I may want to make a couple of statements here. So the Amendment 6 is in all criminal prosecutions. That's how that amendment starts. So that basically is the amendment that has to do with criminal prosecutions. And then Amendment 5, let me just finish.
I should have made something clear.
Let me do this.
Or common law.
let me kind of go through this because I'm going to lead you the questions. Amendment 5 is infamous crimes, and then Amendment 7 is suits at common law. So according to the Bill of Rights, there's only these three categories. And I assume that infamous crime is in the same category as criminal prosecutions, but a different level of egregious behavior. So effectively, if I read this correctly, you have two basically kinds of trials, and that's it. You have criminal prosecutions, which I presume is for violation of the law, and everything else falls in common law. Is that a correct, except for infamous crimes, is that correct?
Yeah, well, infamous crimes for the most part, and I shouldn't say that either, the most part either. You see, you have crimes between individuals who are not government agents. You see, you have murders, you have rapes, you have fraud and all those kind of things. You have the right to a jury trial. The Sixth Amendment gives you that. But all criminal trials should be, and basically they were.
But a criminal, let me jump in. Criminal trial is basically a violation of the law. And it seems to me that then, other than violations of the law, everything else falls, except for infamous crimes, falls in the Seventh Amendment suits at common law. Is that a fair statement?
I'm not sure I understand what you're saying.
Well, a suit between individuals, or even a suit between an individual and government, that is not a violation of the law but a dispute, is not a criminal prosecution. The only thing that's a criminal prosecution is when the government says you violated the law.
Well, here's the problem there. You see, we have a lot of law on the books, such as the income tax code.
But set aside for the moment the legitimacy of whether it's a true law or a wrong law. My understanding of this is all crimes, basically violations of law, are to be prosecuted under Amendment 6 with the exception of infamous crimes, and everything else falls under the Amendment 7, the common law.
Well, I think if I understand what you're saying, the Sixth Amendment trial, of course, was supposed to be common law. You see, what has happened is the judges and the prosecutors and the lawyer business, they try to operate criminal courts lots of times like they would an equity or admiralty jurisdiction. In other words, the judge has more authority. But the judge really, in a criminal case, really doesn't have the authority that they're exercising today. That's one of the problems that we have with the courts, because
where do you put equity? An equity, a suit of
I'm
equity.
I'm not hearing you too well for some reason. I don't know
where do you put an equity, a matter of equity? Is that, in your opinion, the Seventh Amendment?
It doesn't go with the Seventh Amendment. There's no equity. There's no equity or admiralty jurisdiction in the Seventh Amendment. None in the Sixth either. None.
Where do you see that the equity gets handled? Do you think it's not covered in the Bill of Rights?
Equity and admiralty jurisdictions. For the most part, you'll find that these are disputes between insurance companies. Corporations. If you've got two corporations that are arguing over copyrights or something, or patents, those end up being in equity or admiralty jurisdiction. And of course, what they have done, you see, they've perverted everything. Everything has been perverted in the legal business because lawyers and lawyer the practitioners. You know, we've got some well-known lawyers, and I could name one of them in particular, whom I know, and he has argued cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, and he's a very, very intellectual type of fellow. And he turned in his Bar Association membership some time back, I think, it's a matter of 5 or 6 years ago, I think, now. And he's not the only one. I have had conversations with a number of attorneys that have, dropped their Bar Association membership because they just, they all have basically the same complaint. They say they cannot be part of a criminal organization.
I want to come back to this point because I'm trying to lay the basic foundation here to understand this stuff. And so, in your opinion, where does an equity or admiralty matter get covered in either the Constitution or the Bill of Rights?
Admiralty and equity don't come under the Bill of Rights at all. They're in Article 3 of the Constitution.
So you believe that there's a different kind of a process to make those decisions that are not covered by these Bill of Rights?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you've got, especially the big fraud cases. I was just reading some stuff. I watch the ranching, the cattle business. I get some of their papers and such, and fellows stole a lot of money buying people's cattle, and then not their checks bounced and one thing another. And two of them have pled guilty, and the prosecutors are asking the judge to give them 10 years apiece in federal prison. You see, you've got those kind of crimes, and the common law isn't going to work for those kind of...
In suits of common law, what do you put in that category, and then what do you put in the category of criminal prosecutions?
Criminal prosecutions, of course. You see, you've got so much of the criminal prosecutions today are under administrative law. And when you invoke the Seventh Amendment and demand a common law jury trial, it basically throws the administrative law in the trash, and the jury, they decide whether the charge or the one that is being accused of doing something illegal, he is going to have his day in a court where his sovereign neighbors, the people in his community, the other sovereigns, it's going to be 12 sovereigns sitting on that jury. And he is one of the sovereigns, and he is a sovereign and he has a right to be tried by the sovereign rather than a public servant. And that is a big difference. And of course, this is one of the things that came about with Magna Carta. And it was a major improvement on the system. And that's, like I said initially, it takes some time to, get a good handle on how this works, for the simple reason that we have been so mentally crippled. And that's the best term that I can come up with to believe that judges are they're smarter than the rest of us, and they have this power as a judge, and that's one of the mistakes that we have made in this country. We've held judges up at a level where they really don't belong. And, you know, I can tell you horror stories about judges. And, of course, I sued a federal judge in 1993. And people said, you can't sue a judge. Well, that judge was violating my constitutionally secured rights. And when I sued him, of course, it went up to the U.S. Supreme Court. It was docketed in August of 96. And it was, we went up through, I had gone through the district pen and the appellate courts. The Ninth Circuit basically told me right at the beginning that it was a case that belonged in the U.S. Supreme Court because it was first impression. And, of course, I had checked that all out before I filed this thing. And so the case was docketed in August. In December, the Solicitor General, who is the attorney in the Justice Department that defends the government, if the government is a party to an action, the Solicitor General is the one who defends the government before the U.S. Supreme Court. And the Solicitor General in December of 96 noticed all the parties to the action that he was not going to oppose me, that what I was saying was, it was all prima facie evidence because it was all a matter of record in the court. And the judge's signature was on orders and such that he had no authority to make. And I had challenged his conflict of interest, and he ignored that. He ignored that challenge, and he went ahead and violated my constitutionally secured rights, Title 18, Section 241, 242, and it's the criminal statutes. And actually, if we'd had a grand jury that had been available, he would have been prosecuted criminally. But I sued him under Title 42, which is where you sue a government agent for damages. I would rather have collected some damages from that judge rather than see him go to jail. So, you know, I've been looking at this Seventh Amendment for a long time, and I'll tell you, we've pretty much every case that we've been involved in, we've shut down the tax court.
How do you define the term common law?
Why?
How do you determine what is the definition of common law to you?
Well, I wouldn't even try to define it other than that it is the law. You see, we are supposed to learn at our mother's knee. The difference between right and wrong, we're supposed to learn that we don't steal, we don't lie. That's common law. The Ten Commandments is common law. And there's a lot of common law out there.
Here's
and
a definition from Bouvier's dictionary in 18. Here's a definition read from Bouvier's dictionary in 1856. Let's see if this is consistent with your view of common law, because there is a debate about what common law is. That's why I wanted to raise this issue.
Go ahead.
Bouvier's, which is the one that is the constitutional law dictionary, says, that which derives its force and authority from the universal consent and immemorial practice of the people. Does that sound like the definition that you'd agree to?
It sounds like a lawyer wrote it. Because I think that what I just said about the common law, it's where we the people
understand.
That's
what it basically says. That which derives its force and authority from the universal consent and immemorial practice of the people.
Yeah.
And let's compare that definition to Black's Law Dictionary, 7th edition. The body of law derived from judicial decisions rather than from statutes or constitutions. In other words, Bouvier's in 1856 says the common law belongs to the people. Black's dictionary says the common law belongs to the state. And it seems that the turning point at all this is in 1938, Erie Railroad versus Tompkins. Justice Brandeis writes the opinion stating there is no federal grand common law. The authority and only authority is the state. It seems to me that the word common law is at issue here and that there seems to be a perversion of what it means.
Well, what happened, of course, you see, in Brandeis's day, you know, he was a U.S. Supreme Court judge, and he made some very bad decisions, I believe, but he also made some very good decisions. And he was kind of a mixed bag. But by the time Justice Brandeis was sitting on the Supreme Court, the legal profession had pretty well monopolized all of the legal maneuvers, the legal profession. They dominated the courts. You see, it was in the 1890s that the Supreme Court made that ruling, and I can't remember the case now, but they made the ruling that, jurors have the authority to nullify law and such, but you don't. The judges and such, they don't have to tell the jury that. They don't have to explain that to the jury. So when Justice Brandeis come along, the common law that is going to come back, I can assure you of that. I can absolutely guarantee you that the common law is going to come back, and it's not going to be, how would I say it? It's not going to be where legal profession can tamper with it, because I've had many discussions with attorneys about this, and you know, the fact that I say that the Seventh Amendment common law jury is the highest court in the United States of America, and I am absolutely convinced. That's why I wanted you to read that last part of the Seventh Amendment.
Want me to read that now, Red?
Yeah, read it.
So I'll skip the middle part. So the first part, in suits at common law, and then it says, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise reexamined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law.
That's the part, that's where the power is. I have asked attorneys about the Seventh Amendment, and once in a while I'll find one that'll say, oh, that's the where it secures the right to a jury trial in a civil case. I have never talked to one that remembered that the facts tried by a jury cannot be reexamined by any. That three-letter word is pretty inclusive. Any court of the land doesn't dare touch that verdict of a jury, of a common law jury. The jury is the highest court in the land because it is made up of 12 sovereigns. The nine justices of the U.S. Supreme Court are nine government agents. Now, that, to me, is pretty clear.
So you would say that basically in a case where you were, say, let's have a in the case of Defend Rural America, for example, we believe that the agencies are overstepping their boundaries in pretty egregious behavior. So there's a suit here involving their right jurisdiction. It's not necessarily a crime in the sense that we're not saying you violated a law specifically. What we're saying is you're exercising authority you don't have. So your belief is that falls under common law jurisdiction?
I don't know why, but your voice is not coming through clear. There's an echo at times, and I don't know where that's coming from, but I'm not the best. I don't have the best hearing anymore, of course. 80 years or plus of wear and tear on the ears, I guess, is showing up. But I don't know why, but I'm not sure what you were saying because I just wasn't hearing it well. If you could give me another shot on that, and I'll...
Let me see if I can speak slower. Can you hear me okay now?
You don't have much volume, and I don't have any volume control on this phone that I'm using, and it's been a very good phone, and it...
Can anybody hear me?
What?
Can anybody hear me? Red, you've got a bad connection because your sound is not coming through clear either. Kirk's got a good connection. I believe I've got a good connection. If somebody's got a computer that's not muted close to them, that may be a part of the problem. But you're not coming through that clear.
I'm going to switch phones here.
Good move.
I'm going to switch phones. Let's see how this one works. Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I'll try this one for a bit. But I've used that same phone for practically all of our Thursday night talk radio thing. And so I've had such good luck with it. Let's try it again.
Can you hear me okay now, Red?
That's a little better.
Okay, I'll try and speak up as much as I can. The question, I guess, is, in your opinion, if we have complaints against government agencies for acting outside of their authority, outside their jurisdiction, do you believe that basically falls under common law?
Yes, absolutely. If people are being damaged, If they're being hurt, damaged, injured in any way, it should come under common law. You know, I know that we haven't recovered enough yet at this point to really make it work like we would like to have, but I think that it's coming. I think that the people of this country, once they find out about this, I think they're going to want to go this route. And, of course, this is why I've watched the sovereignty arguments coming up across the country in state legislatures. Because when I asked those people back there years ago, in the sovereignty movement, where did they confirm, where did they exercise their sovereignty? They couldn't answer it. But it's really the only place in the whole system where we, the people, have the authority to have the final say on the law. That's the way it was back. It's always been that way. There's always been a king or a dictator or something. If there was a controversy at the lower level, it would work up through the system and eventually get to the top man in the sovereignty list or the pecking order. The king or the authority would rule, and that was the end of the argument right there. And that's why the common law, why they put the Seventh Amendment in there, because that has to be where the sovereignty rests is with the jury And that's how they exercise their sovereignty. They confirm the fact that they are the sovereign above the government. Now, this is it's so basic. It is so basic that we the people, if we're going to have liberty, if we're going to have freedom, we have to exercise our sovereignty. There has to be something in the system that will enable us to exercise our sovereignty. And Magna Carta did that in 1215, and old King John didn't like it at all, but it took him out of the position of the top of the pecking order and put him on the bottom. And it put the people who had been serfs on the land, that put the people above, at the top of the pecking order. So I like that pecking order thing, and I think it's pretty easy to understand. And I just think that we need more people talking about using the pecking order. And I'm amazed. I've been talking pecking order for over 30 years.
Now, Red, if I need to kind of jump in, because I promised Terry I'd keep this segment to 45 minutes, if that's okay.
Oh, so boy.
We just need to wrap this up. Something we can talk about more, I know, but I need to wrap up.
Yeah.
I think that the residual questions, and we won't talk about them tonight, Red, but residual questions for me is, when we talk about the common law, it's going to be, is this oral? Is this written? Is it common sense? You know, there's a lot of questions for me that surround this whole concept, and I definitely appreciate your time tonight for helping to explain some of this and how some of these common law courts are supposed to work. And Terry, I'll turn it back over to you.
Well, thank you, Kirk. Red, if you've got a final comment on that or thought that you want to complete your thought on that, please feel free to do
that. I have to kind of make an excuse here. I've had a long day and a lot of stress here around our house, a lot of commotion. And of course, some of those many strokes I've had have not given me any, it hasn't made it easier for me to, answer questions and all like I would like to. I do a little more stuttering and such, and my recall isn't as good. So I hope people will excuse, my stumbling around a little bit. And so I think it was a conversation. I think it was something that was really needed at this point. We've got to get some people out there that'll pick up this ball, because I'm going to drop the ball one of these days. And I hope there's somebody, and I hope there's a lot of people out there that are going to get a grasp on the common law and the common law jury. And I want to say this. I think the founders put number 7 on that amendment, on that bill, article of the Bill of Rights, because number 7 is God's law, is God's number. And that's just kind of a personal viewpoint on my part. So back to you, Terry.
Well, Red, let me make a quick comment, and you can clarify before we make the transition and bring in all the other folks who are patiently waiting, and I thank everyone for being patient. The Bill of Rights was never intended to handle matters of admiralty or equity. The Bill of Rights is a declarative and restrictive statements to limit the power of the federal government over the states and people. The other thing is that I've noticed people wanting to make a distinction between the amendments as to what applies to civil versus what applies to criminal. And in general, you can do that, but there are exceptions to that, particularly in relationship, for example, to the Seventh Amendment in that the federal government may claim that you owe money, and by not paying that money, you may be committing a crime. So you can still use the Seventh Amendment in that case if the monetary value is over $20, which obviously in almost all cases it is. Would you disagree with that, Red?
I'm not sure where you came from or where you were going there for sure. I used the Seventh Amendment in that case where I sued the judge. And shortly after that, I filed another action. Only I used an attorney because I was out of town so much and I had to have somebody local that could monitor the case and keep the court from and the government from because the government knew where I was at all the time, whether I was on the East Coast in Florida or wherever, and they knew that I would not be able to make it back for a hearing if they came up with a hearing all of a sudden, just try to give me a hard time. I had to have an attorney. And it was a quiet title action where the IRS had put a lien on the on property of mine without due process and all, and the case just sat there, and it didn't go anyplace. Nothing was happening. The lawyer thought I was crazy filing the action. I gave him the paperwork and paid him for a retainer, and so he gets a telephone call from the district counsel for the IRS. That's the lawyer that represented the district for the Internal Revenue Service, and he gets my attorney gets a call, and he says, we have to settle this case. And he mentioned this case that I had. And my attorney said, he kind of stuttered a little bit. He said, what's going on here? And the counsel said, we have to settle this case because we are going to have a very bad precedent that is being set. That was within a week or so after the case against the federal judge had been docketed with the U.S. Supreme Court. That case was settled, and I got $146,000 out of the Internal Revenue Service. It was my money, of course, but I got that money out of them, and the check didn't bounce. So, I know that we got somebody's attention.
Well, thanks for that. Are we ready to shift? Are we okay to go?
I'm ready.
Okay. Well, tonight we have an interesting situation that has developed over the last, week or so up in New Hampshire. And we've got a number of people who are familiar with the case online with us tonight. We have Andrea, we have Dottie, and also Billy Miller's mother, Marie, should be here with us, possibly some others. And if there are others that have a live mic, I'll allow you to at least acknowledge your presence. Dwayne, I know that you're going to want to make comment at some point in here, and I believe we may also have Doug Millar online as well.
Yes, I'm here.
I'm on a call with a bunch of people around the country. They're going to hear the hockey game.
Okay, when anybody's not speaking, I'm going to ask them, because we've got so many on, I'm going to ask you to mute yourself when you're not speaking. We're getting a lot of echo from some of the cell phones. I'd like to start out with Dottie. Dottie, are you there?
Here. I'm here.
Hi, Dottie.
Hi.
Can you give the folks a little bit of background as to what your involvement with Billy Miller is, and maybe a little bit of history about Billy?
Okay. I met Billy back in March of 2007. Billy is a true constitutionalist. He's a smart man, very intelligent. And I came about to meeting with Billy because he had some issues with the Farmington.
If
are you still there?
Everyone but Dottie should be muted, please.
I met Billy in March of 2007, and he was having some issues of corruption in the Farmington Police Department under the tenure of Scott Roberts, the chief of police there. And I'm having issues with that same police department, although I'm on Maine. And Bill and I compared notes. We compared our documents, exchanged documents, and were, you know, compiling things against the department and some of the officers there. And this is how I came about meeting up with Billy. We both have a project, so to speak, that we are working on, and that is to eradicate the corruption that's going on, the abuses, the deaths that are occurring, and no one's doing anything about it. And in all of my conversations with Bill, I've always found him to be very personable, extremely intelligent. He was always thoughtful, courteous, responsible. He's rational. And I find him to be extremely competent. Billy is a veteran. He was a member of the elite 82nd Airborne Special Forces. I have known him to be a gentleman, as well as a peaceful and caring member of his community. And his disciplined background attests to his character.
Dottie, let's bring Andrea in for just a minute, if it's okay. Andrea, you have a live mic?
I believe I do.
Andrea, can you answer the same questions, and that is, what was your involvement? How do you know Billy Miller? And give us a little bit of Billy's history.
Yes, I can. My name is Andrea Murillo. I'm from the state of Maine, but I venture into New Hampshire for the same purposes that Billy's involved with, corruption that exists. And I have a background as an advocate for justice. I have a major in criminal justice and a minor in social science. I was a policewoman. I worked in the AG's office. And I have a ministry, a youth ministry. As for Billy, I met Billy at the same time Dottie did, in 2007, October 21st. My involvement in this matter goes back to when William exposed corruption then. This exposure rattled some corrupt cages. Billy has a First Amendment right to speak out. What a soldier he was to do so. The repercussion to that exposure was extreme. Billy was then a subject of political hostage position. Dottie will bring forth the timeline and effects that took place. I was a witness to most of these happenings. I attended the bogus court hearings. It is like a maximum of law, but anything similar is not the exact same. The corrupt political moves that have been made upon William Miller is a travesty of justice. It appears there is a deliberate attempt to take the focus away from who Billy really is and what is going on. Billy is a political hostage. Billy had an answer. Billy had had announced his run for sheriff approximately a week prior to the incident that occurred. He was abducted illegally on April 5th, Thursday, with a politically motivated move to silence Billy's run for sheriff. He is being held illegally. Billy is being targeted for exposing corruption. We and our families will be forced to endure the same as Billy if we do nothing. Big government is taking over. Billy is now incorporated by the injection of drugs and being held all against his will. His life is at risk. Drugging continues. His mother is being tortured by all this action. Billy needs to be released yesterday. He is in grave danger. He is a true soldier, and I would trust my life with Billy. There is an injustice going on in New Hampshire that needs national attention. And maybe Dottie could bring up a little bit of the chronological chronology that took place in the court system.
Well, let me try to summarize a little bit of that, and both Dottie and you, Andrea, can correct me if I'm wrong, because, you know, Dwayne and I and Doug have all been digging into this for the last week and spent time on the phone with you guys, as well as we managed at one point to actually reach Billy. Just like you said, I think it was a miracle. But Billy started out as quite a crusader, and he identified and was trying to bring out to the public eye a lot of corruption that was going on in the local police departments there in Farmington. Is that correct?
Correct.
And as a part of that, someone accused him of threatening the chief of police. They used that as an excuse to incarcerate him, and in fact, threw him into a mental ward where he was in a drug-induced state and held without speedy trial for a number of, more months than you should be held in a situation like that. And while he was in a drug-induced state and under duress wanting to get out of that place, they basically coerced him to sign a conditional release, which is now being used nearly 4 years later, after his acquittal at trial. The charges that were brought against him, he was acquitted of, which should have erased the conditional release. However, now, 4 years later, after a clean record, he declares himself as a candidate for sheriff and is hit with a near-midnight raid at his mother's house and thrown back into a mental ward. Is that an accurate description?
Yes, it is.
Correct.
Let me just, if I could, I'll just interject here, Terry, for a second. You were talking about this order that Billy is under. You know, it's a 5-year order by Judge Campy. And this 5-year order is coming up at the end. I think there's maybe 3 months left of it. And, is this probably part of the motive to probably initiate another 5-year order? And there's been a lot of exposure publicly out there on what's been happening. And these corrupt officials and law enforcement, all the way from the local police department up through the county DA's office into the Attorney General's office under the tenure of, at that time, Kelly Ayotte, who is now a U.S. Senator. A lot has been said about this, and they want to take the spotlight off of them, and they are doing what they are doing to Billy in order to silence him. And I fear that they will silence him for good this time, now that he's locked up. Really concerned about that.
Billy is in grave danger.
I have no doubt of that. I mean, these people have obviously. Let's address this issue of some notice. He, in that conditional release, the condition was that he was to see a health professional every 3 months. He last checked in February, and thus was not scheduled to check in again until May. And for some reason, they issued an order for him to check in last week, and that notice did not get to him. He did not receive that notice until, or was not even aware of the notice until after they picked him up. Is that correct?
Yes.
That's my understanding.
So there's a lot of bogus circumstances here that make it pretty obvious that these people are not affording him due process or even complying with the regulations of the mental health statutes in the state up there. Now, you guys have researched that. You ladies have researched the mental health regulations, and you found that they're not complying with the individual rights requirements of that either, correct?
That's correct.
That's right, and I spoke with Marie, Billy's mother, tonight. Received yet a written notice to Billy, because if they pick him up, they have to give him a written notice. And the doctor did give Billy a notice, a written notice stating there was an absolute revocation of conditional discharge in accordance with RSA 135C, Section 51, Number 4. Now, under that section, it states that they have to give Billy a reason. They have to state the reasons why they have...
Probable cause.
Well, why they revoked this conditional discharge. Give him the reasons in writing. And he has nothing in writing. All they are quoting is their own statute. And the statute just reads, do you want me to read you exactly what they're saying it is? Because if it's not a reason, it's a law.
I don't believe we need to do that.
Okay. I'm saying is he was not told how he violated anything.
Right. So he has no charges on him at this point. And the charges that were put on him 4 years ago that precipitated this conditional release, he was acquitted of, and we've seen the signed orders of the court by the judge acquitting him as not guilty of those charges. Is that correct?
That's correct. And they held him for a long time. This was a trumped up charge.
Now you've said he's in danger. You've said he's
absolutely
in danger.
Absolutely.
Explain in detail and explain specifically what you mean by that.
Andrea, I'll let you take it.
am I still on speaker?
Yeah. Yes, I think so.
Okay. Well,
that's better.
That's better?
That's much better.
Okay. Now, could you repeat that question again?
I'm wanting you to explain. You stated that he's in grave danger. I'd like for you to explain in detail why you believe he's in grave danger.
Well, first of all, the state of Billy's mind was excellent and still seems to be. But there
is a drug.
In spite
of being drugged.
Right. But there is a drug out there, and they have all kinds of drugs that can make you lose your memory. They have truth serums. They have, actually, the police use truth serums. And you don't know what you just come out with anything that you feel is the truth. And Billy is being injected daily. That's why he's in grave danger, because we don't know exactly what he is getting.
Well, I do know what he's getting. He's getting 1,500 milligrams of Depakote.
We don't know that for sure. It's what they're telling us.
Well, Marie mentioned it. I asked her today to verify. If she's on the call, she can, verify that.
Right, but they may be giving him things that we don't know about. When I say that we don't know what he's getting, behind closed doors, we don't know what they do.
Well, when he was there the last time, I got a list of the medications that they were giving him, and it was, I think, four different kinds of meds, and he was like a drunken sailor. I went up to the hospital many times to visit him, and there were times when he could barely walk down the hallway to meet us. He was all over the hallway. He would do things that Billy would not do. Billy doesn't really like the limelight. Billy is quiet. He's frustrated now. He's angry that he's locked up in there. But he's not one that wants to... He's a quiet, soft-spoken man. But he was
but
doing
he's also,
things at the
he's
hospital.
Also obvious, he's also obviously a very passionate person when it comes to corruption.
That's correct.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And when it comes to injury to others, you know, they're accusing him or saying that he may be a harm or a safety to himself or to others. Well, Billy's not going to do anything to himself, and he's disciplined enough as a veteran, and it really burns him up when somebody else is being harmed, and he would not go harm anybody when he's out there crusading for the people who are victims and being badly injured. So it's a bogus charge. This is not Billy Miller.
I believe we've got a live mic from Marie. Marie, do you have a live mic? Can you say hello? Marie? Can you say hello? Perhaps not. You may be muted, Marie. Doug, you may have a live mic. Doug Millar, welcome to Walls in Our Minds, Doug.
Yes, I have a live mic, but I was pushing the unmute, so I missed your question.
Well, I didn't give you a question yet. I was just saying hello and welcome you to the show. Doug, you've got a lot of experience in this kind of stuff. How would you describe the danger that Billy's in at this point?
Well, because he's announced for sheriff and because he's exposing the police chief who's running for sheriff, I would say...
No, he's not, Doug. Correction. The police chief is not running for sheriff. As a matter of fact, he's leaving at the end of the month. He's going to go do something else.
I heard you leaving the police chief's position, but I misunderstood what I read yesterday, I guess. I thought that, is he running against an incumbent or is he running against someone else?
An incumbent, as far as I know. Wayne Estes is the current sheriff. And I haven't heard that he is, retiring either or resigning or going to spend time with the family. He's still running, to my knowledge.
Okay. What I read yesterday was erroneous. So, anyway, the question is, why is he running for sheriff? Does he believe that the sheriff is corrupt?
But the point is that the sheriff's department is trying to keep their own in control, and if Billy gets in there, they're all going to be subject to his investigation, whether they're running against him or not. So I don't believe that that's really an issue as to who he's running against at this point. They're obviously running somebody.
I think, Jerry, that people need to know why he's running for a sheriff and what has the sheriff done. Is he a corrupt person? I suspect that's why Billy's running.
Yes.
And so, therefore, his chief of police is corrupt and dealing in drugs, I understand, working with some people. And so we know that he was in special forces, and so we know the number one drug runners in the nation and the world are the CIA. They learned from the mafia how to operate, and now they've working with the mafia and have since the CIA was created. It's well documented by CIA officers have exposed it. And so, therefore, he's already been exposing criminals in his city and in his state and other states. So, therefore, he's a big danger and threat to the powers that be. And so we have to assume that his life is the reason the police chief ordered him to be arrested right after he announced he was running for sheriff is because he's...
No, let me just correct that, Doug. He was not arrested by the chief of police after he announced his run for sheriff.
The police chief has nothing to do with this.
Right, he was seized,
Let's not use their language. The listeners out here don't know the difference between being seized and being arrested. What he wasn't was he wasn't charged with a crime.
Correct.
But he was.
No,
he
but
was
when you're taken into custody, you're under arrest.
Exactly.
According to the law.
Exactly. So he's being detained without a charge against him and without due process, correct?
Right.
Well, the charge that they're saying is he violated the law, and under those New Hampshire mental health laws, that he violated his condition for release. But he did not. He went for his 3 month thing, meetings or whatever they give him, pills, shots, and because he didn't show up for this out of the air sudden meeting, or I don't know what they wanted him for, that's what they say he violated, according to the rules, the statute.
Doug, do you believe in an institution like that, and under the control of people who have not afforded due process and have surprised Billy with springing this on him after 4 years of no problems, would you trust them to give an accurate record of what they might inject him with?
Of course not. We know that since the local authorities drug people all the time, not by the hundreds, but nationally by the tens of millions, using the SSRI drugs, which are all formulated for the CIA, well documented, because the CIA requested that Eli Lilly create a substitute for LSD. They're having such great success that Alan Dulles, head of the CIA, first director, said, "We need a substitute," asked the CEO of Eli Lilly in 1953. In 1954, he wrote back, and this is well documented, that we have a substitute. How much do you want? What do they call it? Prozac. And then another one, that was because then the Congress banned LSD, and so they started creating all these other drugs because they knew, the head of the CIA said, we've had great success with LSD. We want some substitutes out there. And so now we have about 15 different pharmaceutical drug companies creating mind control drugs, and I'm sure that they are using these drugs on Billy in addition to whatever shots they're giving him.
It comes right back, Doug. They bring it right back to pharmaceuticals under another name.
Of course.
Sure.
If we can get Marie to get Marie, you've got a live mic on our end. If you have muted yourself, you'll need to unmute yourself.
Maybe you should tell her how to do it.
She may not realize she even did it.
If she muted herself, she should know how to unmute herself. So,
just say it,
Marie. Your screen should show you that you're on mute. Or and you push the same button to unmute, upper left-hand corner, it should be, shouldn't it, Terry?
Yes, well, if you can get unmuted, go ahead and jump in here and interrupt us, Marie, because I'd like to ask you a couple of questions. But we've heard Marie's story, all of us here that are on right now have heard Marie's story, and I'd like to, I'll throw it out, and you guys can correct me if I say it wrong, but Marie went to the hospital, and they tried to deny her access to Billy. And she said, "Well, I'm coming." She didn't take no for an answer. And she went, and the guard that was there told her basically, or the person that she encountered when she got there, told her to go to the waiting room and sit down. And she basically said to that person, "Do you have a mother?" And they said, "Well, sure." And she said, "Well, if you were, you know, in a situation like this, wouldn't you want to be comforted by your mother?" And so they let her go back into the room with him, and she pretty much stayed there all night, from what I understand. But when she went back again, she said, "I'll be back." And when she came back the next day they basically told her that, you know, he couldn't see anybody again. And apparently, at that point, Representative Tim Comerford got into the situation and attended the hospital with her. And it seemed that their attitude there changed significantly when there was a local government official present. And so they kind of loosened things up. But the point is, they were trying to keep anybody from getting to him while they were inducing him. Is that an accurate tale?
Actually, this is Andrea. I was on the telephone with her to keep her from being harmed. And I wrote down exactly what she told me tonight, if you'd like me to read it. It wouldn't take but maybe 5 minutes.
Go right ahead.
Marie Miller told me, these are exactly her words, and I observed. I was on the telephone. I am a federal marshal, and I was trying to protect her by phone. April 5th, shortly before midnight, three police cruisers from Somersworth, New Hampshire, came to Billy's home to apprehend him. We are not here to arrest Mr. Miller, the officer said. We are here on an order by Dr. McGuire to take Billy to the hospital, Wentworth Douglas Hospital in Dover, New Hampshire. Billy was cuffed, and they took him away. Billy's mother arrived at the hospital at 12:30 a.m., and Mrs. Miller was advised Billy was in the emergency room. She was then advised she could not see him. Mrs. Miller spoke. She said, I am his mother, and I would like to be in there with him, my son. An officer advised her to sit down in the waiting room and wait and shut up. Then security officer Heath came in and informed Marie the Dover Police Department had been called to escort her out of the hospital. Marie called me and advised the security officer that she had a deputy federal marshal on the phone. Marie was in fear of getting hurt. We talked. She then advised me of what was going on and what was taking place, in other words, and asked if I would speak to the security officer. We spoke, and Officer Heath changed his tune and allowed me to stay, Marie says, but ordered Marie to shut her mouth and shut the phone off. I advised her not to turn off her phone and keep me on the line, and I stayed up all night with her on the phone. Marie sat in the waiting room until 3:30 a.m. and kept me on the line as she feared for her safety. Officer Heath sat down and was observing Marie all the time. At 3:30 a.m., Marie asked Officer Heath to please let her see Billy. He replied, sit down. Don't talk. Be still. Marie spoke to Officer Heath. You have a mother. Wouldn't you like to have your mother in the ER with you? Then he told me, you can see William for 15 minutes. Instead, they let her stay till 7:50 a.m. Sheriff came to take Billy to the state hospital in New Hampshire. Then Marie met with Dottie, and Dottie can tell you the rest. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dottie?
Yes.
Didn't you meet with Marie that morning and go visit with Billy?
We went Friday. We went up to the hospital on Friday.
That was the next morning.
It was the next afternoon that we got there. And
okay.
They wouldn't let us see him. And we had the head nurse, I guess, or one of the staff, you know, one of the nurses on the floor came down and said that Billy couldn't have visitors. And I asked, why not? Is something the matter with him? And she said, well, physically he's fine. I said, well, what is not fine? She says he can't have visitors. And then the security guard came over, and he apparently was talking to the doctor, and this security guard had all this medical information and what was going on, which surprises me a little bit, or maybe it doesn't surprise me. And he said he had talked to the doctor, and he cannot have any visitors. And he says, I can't go into the detail, he stayed right there, and Marie wanted to see her son. Then she asked to see the doctor, and the information receptionist made a phone call and said that the doctor would come. We had been there like 2 hours already, and because Marie was not going to leave until she made sure that she saw Billy. And the doctor did come in, and he would not let her go in. He says, I don't know anything about the background of this, and I gave him a little background. However, yesterday when I was looking through my notes that I have from the years past, this Dr. Hink was in the state prison when they transferred Billy from the mental hospital to the state prison for a short while, and he was the one taking care of Billy there, so he knows the background. He was there. He was involved. So now I know that what he said was probably not so anyways. And Marie said the same thing. You know, if you had a mother and she went through that story with him, he says, well, I'll go see if it's okay with the staff or the head nurse. Well, the doctor is the one that gave the order that he couldn't be seen. So now he's got to go talk to the nurse. And he came back and he said, no, you can't see Billy. And whoever Marie spoke to that day told Marie to call first before you come to see Billy. And she says, no, I'm not calling first. And she says, I will be here tomorrow, because it was 8 o'clock and that's closing time, so we have to leave. She says, I will be back in the morning. And they said, you call first. And she asked, does anybody else call? And they said, no. So she said, well, why should I have to call? So Marie did not call, and she went with Representative Tim Comerford and Gus, another friend or someone that knows the family or knows Billy. And as you said, they were very nice, couldn't be nicer, and allowed them to go in and meet with Billy. And after the representative left, and sometime in the afternoon, I called Marie, and she had her cell phone with her, and she was in the room with Billy. And I asked how Billy was making out, how the treatment was, and she says, do you want to speak with him? I said, yes. So I asked him how it was going, and it was awful. He wanted to be out of there. And then I heard a voice in the background, a man, telling him to get off the phone and shut the phone off. And Billy says, I will complete my call. And he said it calmly, I will complete my call. And I said to Billy, what are they trying to do? Have you hang up the phone? He said, yes. And there was something about, I still heard some sounds in the back, but I couldn't make out the conversation. And Billy said something about they were concerned about it for a matter of privacy, and then the phone got disconnected. And then I couldn't, call Marie back. There was no reaching Marie after
ladies,
that. And that's
ladies,
scary.
Ladies, we have Representative Tim Comerford on the phone with us now, on the call with us. And I'd like to welcome you, Tim, to Representative, to Walls in Our Minds radio show. And at Revolution Radio, and I just want to thank you and express our appreciation on behalf of everyone here that you're taking the time to really look into this case. And it's obvious that you're a very caring individual, which today in any kind of government position seems to be rare. Representative Comerford, if you would please say hello and make whatever comment that you would like. Well, you do have a live mic, Representative Comerford. You may need to unmute yourself. Well, we must have lost him. If you can get a live mic and want to jump into the conversation, we welcome you to please interrupt us, Representative.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, Marie. Welcome to Walls in Our Minds.
Oh, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I've been sitting here trying to figure out, so I had to interrupt the call completely and dial myself in again. So
it's good to hear your voice.
Thank you. I was at the state hospital again today with Billy, and she is just suffering. It's so hurtful to me. I had a horrible day today, and I asked if the doctor could speak with me for a while, and the doctor came, Dr. Hinks, and I asked him when Billy is going to have a hearing. He said, well, I don't know nothing about it. Maybe tomorrow morning. I said, tomorrow morning, it's a little late notice for me to bring my lady friends with me. And he said, well, I really don't know. And then he approached William and told him that he should agree to the Proloxin, I can't even pronounce it anymore, I'm so upset today, Prolixin. He should agree to Prolixin injections. And Billy said, no. He said, you've done enough to me. I will not agree to any injections. I will not. And then the doctor, of course, left, said goodbye. So my son is in there. I don't know what they're doing to him because he was quite irritable today. And I left there with a broken heart. And I don't know how much longer I can take it. I just don't know.
Can I interject something here, Terry?
I'm sorry?
Could I just interject something
certainly.
Here?
Certainly, certainly.
And let Marie get her thoughts about her again here. You know, she's talking about this hearing. Under their own regulations, their own law, within 3 days, Billy is supposed to have a probable cause hearing. And it's the burden is upon him to prove, you know, why he should not be in there. Now, it's been more than 3 days. They don't count holidays or weekends, but it's still been more than 3 days. And the last time that they pulled this hearing, Billy was notified the night before of a next morning hearing. And I was concerned. I was talking to Andrew about that today. Are they going to pull the same stunt that they'll tell Billy at midnight, oh, by the way, you have a meeting tomorrow morning. Then he can't get a hold of us. He may get a hold of Marie, but, I mean, I'll be by the phone, but it takes me an hour and a half to get where I have to go. So I would have, you know, more than 20 minutes before the hearing. And I'm wondering if they're going to pull again tomorrow. And if we should go up there, girls, in case.
Uh-huh. Something has to be done.
Well, yes, something must be done. And what happened, anything transpired today in that direction where any actions have been taken that we can talk about to seek putting pressure on them to release him?
I have an idea. This is Andrea. If there is a lawyer or an attorney or a legal master that is hearing this call, we ask of you to step forward and help this man and his mother and his family, because it would take a legal mind to get into the legal corruption. And if so, perhaps they could contact Terry and let Terry know that they'd be willing to write a letter to the Institute. And I believe that a lawyer with a good name would be able to help Billy get released. Thank you.
Well, along that same line that Andrew just talked about, under their own regulations, under Section 135C52, anyone whose conditional discharge is revoked, which is what they've done, may appeal the decision to the chief administrator. And If Billy did this, he would be entitled to a hearing on the appeal within 5 days. Or, and that excludes holidays and weekends, or under Section 135 at 54, a habeas corpus comes under this section, and it says that this chapter shall not be construed to deprive any person of the benefits of the writ of habeas corpus. And he could file this, and the court issuing the writ of habeas grants relief, then the court shall enter an order discharging the person, and then they would transmit a certified copy of it to the probate court, and ordering the, his discharge. That could be done by habeas under their own rules. So either an appeal to the administrator or a habeas, if somebody other than Billy's name is on it, might, possibly help. But if they're not giving him his hearing, what?
No, go ahead.
If they're not giving him the hearings that he is entitled to, that's another violation upon them, which is, not out of their ordinary. But Billy doesn't have these rules in his room up there. So if you're not studying this stuff, you don't know what you can do and what you can't do. But these are things that he could do with some help, I would think. Just a thought.
This is Dwayne. Am I coming through okay?
You are live,
yes.
Dwayne.
Well, I think with all good points put up here, and we've discussed this quite a few times this weekend, but I think I'm playing devil's advocate here. We've got a lot of listeners that are sitting back, probably doing as I'm sitting here piecing this together. And they're going, well, if he was acquitted, this entire mess is a moot point, which is where I know, Terry, I'm beating you to the punch here. But this is the overall picture is he shouldn't be there in the first place.
Right.
Had he been found guilty, and they sentenced him to 5 years under this medical procedure where he's been voluntarily doing it, I would imagine, anyway, if he had been guilty, then there would be a reason for them to continue to play this game. But he was acquitted. The entire process is a moot point. Except the fact that we don't understand why they have him under here, because we don't understand the paperwork. What is their de facto paperwork that holds him here? And this is the investigative process we've been working on the past couple of days. So for the audience's edification here, just to enlighten them, remember that he was acquitted of all this in the first place. He shouldn't have even been going through this the past 4 years.
Absolutely. Right. Everything is null and void.
Correct.
Everybody went quiet at the same time.
Dwayne is correct.
Of course he's correct.
Any order that was issued during that time should be null and void.
I'm going to ask that Red Beckman, if you got any ideas here, Red, that you might interject. I don't want to try to play lawyer or even legal counsel advisor here, but I recall Joyce Rosewall, rest in peace. She passed away here a few months ago, but she was quite a legal researcher. And one of the things that she talked about on this show once upon a time, about a year ago, was that a person could appoint someone. Actually, they could not appoint. That's a wrong word. The word would be assign to someone their persona. In other words, that they wouldn't go as a representative of them, but as you would convey a title, you could give a written conveyance of your persona. That is, they could go in as that person, not pro se, not representing that person, but as that person. And in that case, there may be a possibility that they could go in and place a motion before a court to vacate that conditional release based upon the fact that he was acquitted of the charges that initiated that action in the first place. Red, I think this may be outside of our scope, but Red, if you have any comment, I'd appreciate it.
Well, this, of course, is what happens when the common law is shoved aside and is not utilized, and this is a serious case, and it probably would be quite difficult. His mother is how old? How old is she? Will she tell me or tell the audience how old she is? Is she?
Today is my birthday. Today is
happy
my
birthday.
73.
In a case like this, it might be. You see, I think you're going to have to go to federal court. And you could even go to a federal grand jury, you see, and bring this to attention of the federal grand jury. You probably only have one federal grand jury in New Hampshire. I don't know. But there's some smaller population states that'll only have one. You see, if his mother were to go to federal court and file a Title 42, that's federal law, Title 42 is where you can file an action against a public servant for damages. And,
we did that.
Why?
We've done that. And
did you use an attorney to do it?
Nope. No.
What did the court do about it?
It was dismissed. And the
who dismissed
the judge,
it?
Judge Joseph LaPlante.
Did you file it under the Seventh Amendment?
There were a few amendments and. Gosh, I don't have the actual filing right in front of me right now, but it went on for maybe a month or so, back and forth with different things. But
okay, let's get some clarity here. Let's get some clarity. Hold on. Let's just one person at a time talk.
How long ago was this,
Marie? What year did we do that? Was it 09?
In 08. 08.
08.
In February.
08.
Well,
okay.
Well, there's a lot changed in the legal game since 08. You see, the case has to be filed under the Seventh Amendment. And when you file a case under the Seventh Amendment, the federal judge or state judge or anybody else cannot dismiss it legally.
Wow.
If they try to dismiss it, you just put their name on it, you file the case, and you reserve the right to add additional defendants if they violate your constitutionally secured right to due process. So you put that right in your complaint that you're going to reserve the right to add the name of anybody, any public servant that tries to tamper with this effort to get due process. And you file a Title 40. What?
I was just going to say, there's a conflict with the judge that was sitting on that bench. He was a former prosecutor under the U.S. Attorney General's office. And
sure.
a complaint was filed in his office. And he should have disqualified himself from that. And when I found out about it, we put in a filing on that, and he dismissed the case. He should not have been sitting there.
Well, you see, if he gets, it's not supposed to be filed in his office. It's supposed to be filed in the clerk court's office. It's not filed in the judge's office. It's filed in the clerk of court's office.
No, and I'm talking about
a complaint. You get your
criminal
summonses
complaint
and everything to all of the defendants. But I think you're best off just picking on one, most, and if possible, just no more than two defendants. And the reason for that is you want to call these other people as witnesses. If you've got them all listed as all defendants, because you can go after them later, you want to be able to subpoena your county district attorney, the judge that you've been having to deal with on the county level or state level. You want to be able to subpoena those and make them explain themselves. And of course, I can't do that much for you on this kind of a format or a program like this. There was a case, and this is a different kind of a case, of course, but a guy from one state went into another state and was picked up by the city cops in this other city, in this other state, and because every city and every county is desperate for funds, and so they've raised all your traffic penalties and everything else. And this case, they had this fellow, they hauled him off to jail, they made him put up a $750 cash bond to get out, and they had a battle for 6 months. Now, this guy was pretty sharp, as far as the law was concerned and one thing and another, but he wasn't an attorney. And then he was, they kind of got him backed into a corner of the city magistrate or the city traffic court, I should say. They just continued to rule against him and everything, and they got him backed into a corner. And somebody told him, said, well, you better call and check with this guy that's been working with the Seventh Amendment, which he did. And he told me the story, and I told him, I said, go to the closest federal court, file a Title 42, 1983 case, Section 1983, and you're asking for a common law jury to determine the amount of damages. And you see, you're asking for a common law, Seventh Amendment common law jury, and that's title, or you go to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, and it's Rule 38. This is a Rule 38 case, and it's beyond the judge. If he tries to dismiss it, why, he can be in more trouble because you can add his name to the list. Anyway, you see, you have a constitutionally secured right, and you have a statute, a criminal statute, Title 18, Sections 241, 242 cover. If somebody denies you your constitutionally secured rights, why, that's a crime. That's a federal crime, a serious crime. And
those
so,
were added in that.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, in that traffic case, this guy, he had his back to the wall, and of course he went and filed that. And when the judge, I told him, I said, just go after the city judge to start with, traffic court judge. Go after him. You just name him as a single defendant. And when he got his summons, he, on his own motion, dismissed the action. On his own motion. He dismissed the action. He called in the city attorney or sent him a note and said, I have dismissed that case. And he says, you are ordered to write this man a letter or whatever and telling him the case is dismissed and apologize for the city. And he said the city cops were wrong. And the guy got the letter from the district attorney or the city attorney that was prosecuting the case. he got the letter and saying that the case had been dismissed and that the city cops had not done their job properly and one thing another. I haven't heard how much he has collected, but he's collected a considerable amount of money from what I hear. And so this is a little different. This is a different. But what I'm saying is that when these people read this lawsuit, they've got to go to the books and they've got to check out this Rule 38 in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. It secures your right. It secures your right to a Seventh Amendment common law jury. But you can't have an attorney. This is why I asked why our subject here is the age of his mother. If she is the one who has been damaged, you know, very severely, along with him, and this is her son, and so she can, demand that a jury determine how much she has been damaged. And when you read that Seventh Amendment, you'll find out that the Seventh Amendment common law jury is the highest court in the land. Now, I see we're running out of time here, and I've run on too long, but I know that most of these judges in this country know about what is happening with the Seventh Amendment, the common law juries. We've won every case that I know of that we've used this on tax court, and because tax court is not a court at all. It's a kangaroo apparatus to take people's money. And we've been able to destroy it with that Seventh Amendment. So,
let's have a follow up call, Red, so that
yes.
we can be very clear about this and not be time constrained. We have about 7.5 minutes left to go in this show, and I'm not sure exactly how to close this out, other than to try to reiterate what Red is saying. What Red is saying is something I guarantee you was not the procedure that you followed when you tried to go to that federal court before.
So, can I clarify that, Terry?
Yes.
Can I clarify? Okay, I wanted to ask if I could make a clarification just so the audience would know. The complaint, I think he thinks that we sent the court complaint to the U.S. attorney. There were two different complaints I was talking about. We filed the complaint against the chief of the police in the court with the clerk. There was another criminal complaint filed in the U.S. Attorney General's office for an investigation over an issue that went on in Farmington, New Hampshire. So there were two different complaints. So we did file it in the court where we were supposed to. The other complaint I'm speaking about was under the tenure of Colin Connell, the U.S. attorney, and Judge LaPlante used to be in that office and worked under him, but he left that office and became the judge in this case.
Okay, but what I'm trying to tell you is that you guys did not set a common law court, and what Red is trying to tell you is that that's what you need to do. You need to set a common law court, and under the Seventh Amendment of the Bill of Rights, the Seventh Article of the Bill of Rights, you can set a common law court, but you have to do it in a specific way. And I guarantee you, you guys have not even that was not done. Even though you might have been working under the right title, and you might even been at the right court, the procedure that Red's talking about, we will make clear to you in a follow-up call, because there's just no way that's going to happen in the next 5 minutes.
Right. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Okay,
what Red,
thank you.
One of the things that Red has done is that he has gone in and declared the judge to be a government agent, which makes him incapable of making an impartial decision or on a finding of law or finding of fact. And by doing that, you basically get him to recuse himself. He can still administer the court. He can still preside, but he cannot be the judge of a determination of law or finding of fact. You need to get to a common law jury to do that. That's why you use the Seventh Amendment. And you have to go in there pro persona. You cannot go in there and say, I'm pro se. You can't even represent yourself. You have to be yourself when you walk into that court, and you have to declare that. Red, is that an accurate statement?
Yes. Don't get any attorney involved other than if you can find an attorney that's willing to go and help you sit at your elbow, but he cannot speak for you. If he speaks for you, you're down the tube. But you speak for yourself, but if you can get a friendly attorney that agrees with your viewpoints and such, he can help you with the questions, and he can write the questions for you and give them to you. And this isn't something that's happening every day, but I don't know if you heard the first part of the program where I mentioned that I filed an action. I sued the senior federal judge in the state of Montana, and I used the Seventh Amendment, and the case was docketed with the U.S. Supreme Court. The Solicitor General noticed all the parties to the action that he was not going to oppose me. That case is still docketed with the U.S. Supreme Court. You can't find it. They have it buried. You can't find it. And they never will hear. They've never heard that case. And that was filed, that was docketed in August of 96. Because this shakes up the legal profession right to its foundation. So, but Rule 38 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure is there. Congress has to, they had to write that. They had to put that in there because the Seventh Amendment is there, and it's, well, as far as I'm concerned, it is the most important of all of the 10 articles of the Bill of Rights. The Seventh is far superior to all of them.
Okay, thank you.
But we will follow up with Red and set a time when we can have this conversation off the air. Dwayne, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
I'm going to ask you in 2.5 minutes to wrap this up and to close us in prayer, especially for Marie while she's online with us tonight.
Well, wonderful to have Marie sitting with us. Marie, you've been through a lot, and boy, your emotional testimony a couple nights ago on Doug's call was pretty profound. It tugged at my heartstrings. So it's good to have you with us, and we're glad that you're getting the help you need. We're getting this out to the nation. Not everybody is going to jump on the bandwagon and get in here with us, but we're going to be counting on those that understand that only good people are going to stand for good things. The Bible says, deal courageously, and the Lord shall be with the good. And only some of us on this call understand that. A lot of people in this nation have forgotten passages, something like that, and they've forgotten the truth of the scriptures that really was the foundation for common law that began this nation when the Puritans first came here. And Marie, I want to thank you for all your patience with us, and I want to thank the Heavenly Father, O great King, O Yahweh, thank you so much for being such a wonderful King of Kings, giving us the law that we understand, waking us up to the fact that we need to get back to your law, the way you established it, the way we then can see it, put it together, and live in harmony with you and our brothers if we would get back together to that law. Father, we don't want the Luciferians, the Satanists, or just the secularists to try and steer us away from that. So we do seek you here, Father, with the whole of our hearts, coming together in your name and your wisdom, that we might find your way once again to bring this nation back to the way it used to be, when it once had a glorious shining for you, Father. We ask these things in the name of your Son, Yeshua HaMashiach, or Jesus Christ, the power of your Holy Spirit, that Marie, Andrea, Dottie, Gus, Tim, I shame he couldn't get in here, but also definitely Red and Terry and Dr. Kate, Doug, everyone on the call, we'll be able to continue to fight for this truth in this issue or others. In the name of your Son, Father, we might do so for the cause of peace and truth. Amen. And amen.
Good night, everyone, and thank you for joining us tonight. Doug, thanks for coming over to Walls in Our Minds and taking time away from your regular show. Marie, Andrea, Dottie, thank you so much, and we will be following up with you. Feel free to call. You've got my number, and I will be glad to hook you in with Red. And I don't know if Sharon is listening tonight, but we'll be getting some publicity in that arena as well. So thank you very much, and we'll see everyone next week for Walls in Our Mind.
His face.